here. This is not my first time here. My wife, Shonda, and I were able to worship here, I think, two or three times last year. My last time, I remember very well because I got to play the djembe drum for the African fashion show. So that was a lot of fun. Trying to nail down Pastor Steve on this service.
Impossible.
So I preach at so many different places now. I was pastor of Holy Cross Lutheran Church in Livermore from 2006 through 2022. And I'm now on leave from call. I took a position as executive director for Open Heart Kitchen at the beginning of 2023, so I'm a little more than a year in on that. And so my official status, as we were talking about earlier, is I am on leave from call. This is the church's way of sort of hanging on to you, but you're kind of dangling out in the wind a little bit. So part of my contract, if you will, with the Sierra Pacific Synod is that I do supply preaching, I do leadership coaching with the Synod, with church councils, with call committees, all those wonderful things. So I do this for 3 years, and then after that, no one really knows what happens. So I'm enjoying being executive director. I feel like it's all the ministry in the world I could ever want. We just opened a new facility in Livermore, and it's just finished its full third week called Vineyard. It is a 23 permanent supportive apartment complex coupled with laundry, showers, food, overnight shelter, housing navigation, case management, domestic violence advocacy. All these things are there in this facility. This is a $26 million facility that's in Livermore. And we are now building out a 19,000 square foot warehouse out by the lab off of Patterson Pass, which will be the future home of Open Heart Food Bank. We are the Alameda County Community Food Bank's East County Redistribution Organization. So, yeah. So we are staying busy, but when I would ask Steve, you know, should I, at this part, should I stand up front or should I stand in the back? He usually says, yeah. And, you know, it's usually like, whatever you want to do. And I feel that same freedom and flexibility and spirit in all of you. So thank you for your warm and gracious welcome. Coming, you know, if I weren't hopping around the Synod preaching in different places, I would be here. So as that settles down, which I hope it does soon, this is where I feel most at home. So thank you for welcoming me and Shonda. You've not met my kids yet. I have a 21-year-old daughter, Zoe, who's on her way as we speak to Mexico for a cruise. And I have an 18-year-old daughter, Journey, who takes a couple classes at Las Positas in Livermore and works at Livermore Area Parks and Rec as a coach for basketball. And I have a 14-year-old son, Sam, who is in eighth grade at Christensen Middle School in Livermore. So, and my wife, Shonda, she also works for Open Heart Kitchen. She is the operations director. So even though my title is fancier than her, she's really the boss of the organization. She's the boss at home and the boss at work. So it was the week of August 18th, 2002, and I had received some wonderful news just weeks before that Shonda would be welcoming our first child into the world on or around August 21st at the latest. It's funny how we've kind of reached a point in that we can kind of schedule these things now or get pretty close. And so Zoe was born on August 20th at 11 p.m. after Shonda had been in labor for 2 full days. And I think it's difficult for men in particular to understand what it's like for a woman to carry a child in her womb, to be so inextricably bound up with another human being in that way. But there was a moment for me after Zoe's birth that I think will come as close as I could ever feel to knowing what it feels like to be so connected to another human being. And it happened when I was there standing with my face pressed against the glass, looking into the nursery at all the little ones lying in their beds, and I finally spotted mine, Zoe. She was 7.5 pounds of pure light. It was a front row seat to what felt like a view of an exploding star packaged in this tiny little humanity. Even better were the moments when she would stop the crying and look around the room, and I often wondered what those little eyes were searching for. The musician in me wants to believe she was already looking around for the first notes from which she would begin her life symphony. But every so often, Zoe's eyes would scan the room, and then for a brief moment in time, they would stop on me. And it felt like a laser shooting straight through me. How could this little clod of nothing already make me want to aspire to so much more? One look and I felt like I couldn't breathe. The oxygen in the room evaporated, and heaven and earth met in this lovely embrace. When Shonda was finally on her feet again and Zoe was cleared to go home, I remember walking to the car and wondering if I would ever know that feeling again. And then three years later, my second child, Journey, was lying in that same bed in that same nursery. And 4 years after that, my son, Sam. And each time left me speechless and breathless. Few moments have left me speechless since. Seeing my wife walk down the aisle was one of them more than 23 years ago. The thought of my mom dying, who I lost to cancer when I was 3 years old, leaves me speechless. I speak in tears when I think about that. And I wonder sometimes if those moments in our life that leave us speechless and breathless are somehow God's way of letting us know we're not alone. One author that I remember reading in my childhood referred to these experiences as rumors of another world. I don't know about you, but it's easy to get caught up in our day-to-day mundane routine ritual of life that sometimes I think we forget about these extraordinary, beautiful moments that are right in front of us. In those moments of ineffable wonder, wrought with joy and pain, it's almost as if God has created this tiny little thin place between the lining of this world and the next, and that if we were to simply close our eyes and press against that fabric in those liminal spaces of our lives, we could almost feel the breath of God against our face. I'll never forget seeing my girls through that fabric and watching them being poked and prodded by a nurse, the screams emanating from the nursery that were sounds of joy, sounds of life, because crying and deep breaths confirm that we are alive. I would have done anything to freeze those moments and to have remained in that space forever. But moments like those are not meant to be held for very long. They're not meant to be domesticated. Those kinds of moments remind me of Mary Oliver's poem, Blackwater Woods, where she writes that to live in this world, you must be able to do three things. Love what is mortal, hold it against your bones, knowing your own life depends on it, and when the time comes to let it go, let it go. And as I look back on those nursery times, the only thing greater than seeing my children see me were all the future moments I imagined where we'd see each other with familiar but new eyes. What I learned in those tender moments between parent and child is that the most powerful moments, the most powerful experiences in our lives that are honored the most are honored not by wishing them to be frozen in time, but by the willful and incredible desire to be inspired by them going forward. Imagine if we could come to look at one another, from our family to our friends, from our coworkers to the stranger on the street, with the love and tenderness we first felt when we laid eyes on our children. And I'm learning that the most memorable life-changing experiences are honored and cherished when they go on changing us every day. We honor those experiences not by locking them away in the deepest, most sacred recesses of our memory, but by calling upon them each and every day and allowing them to continue to shape us. Transfiguration Sunday is where we find ourselves today. And when Jesus is transfigured in front of the disciples, their initial reaction is the desire to freeze frame the action and live in it forever. Up here is so much better than down there. And Peter, in particular, is convinced that building three dwellings will go a long way in encapsulating the moment one building for Lutherans, one for Presbyterians, and one for Baptists. But we have to walk quietly because the Baptists only think they're the ones that have a dwelling, so tread carefully. And Peter's not wrong for wanting to freeze this moment. Any good Jew who witnessed what Peter witnessed with Elijah and Moses on scene flanking Jesus would have built something to commemorate the moment. More precisely, a sukkah, a temporary shelter that played a central role in the Jewish celebration of Sukkot, the festival of booths. This shelter, it was patterned on the temporary shelters that workers would erect in the fields because they were out in the field a long time, which was far from the city, and so it took a long time to travel from home to shelter to where they worked. And so to take time, they would build these places of shelter to camp out, as it were, for the duration. And so Sukkot is the harvest festival, but it's also a time to remember the wanderings in the wilderness, this 40-year period between the Exodus from Egypt. So Peter, being the good Jew that he was, sees Jesus, then sees Elijah, then sees Moses appear. They're on a mountain, and all sorts of bells and whistles and light bulbs are going off in Peter's head. His salvation history of his people kicks in, and before you know it, he's thinking about how all of them might be on top of that mountain for a long time, so why not get comfortable? The problem, of course, is that Peter has mistaken this event as one characterized by duration, that is, how long are we going to be up here, rather than one that is marked by transformation. How will my life be changed going forward as a result of this experience? And how am I to share it with those down there? Of course, we today in the 21st century have the detached luxury of looking in on this event to see how erecting three booths probably wasn't the response Jesus was looking for from his prized pupil, if he was looking for a response at all. But how many of us wouldn't have done the same thing? Freeze it, hang on to it, never leave it. Because our lives sometimes hang on to moments like those because they seem so short and few in our lives. Why shouldn't Peter, James, and John hold on to this moment and keep it just for themselves? After all, Jesus asked them, the three of them, to come up to the mountaintop. No one else. There are nine other people at the bottom of the mountain who did not get invited to go up. Philip's not there. Thomas isn't there. Bartholomew, they're not there on the mountaintop. And so it's at this point in this Transfiguration sermon, whenever it comes up, which is every year, that I always feel like there's a decision to be made. We can either attempt to steer our understanding of this text in a way that makes Transfiguration about something that feels very tangible, mountaintops and valleys. For instance, I might talk about the value Jesus added to Peter, James, and John's life by sharing this experience with them. I might then go on to say that Jesus shared this experience with Peter, James, and John so that they could go back down into the valley where the real work is to be done and allow this mountaintop experience to inform all that they do there. Have you ever heard that sermon preached on the Transfiguration before? The one that tells you how awesome it is to be on the mountain, but that the real work is down in the valley. I like that sermon. I love that sermon, in fact. I've preached that sermon. And I think it makes a lot of sense to say that oftentimes we go up to the mountaintop to have those mountaintop experiences, when we're there, we learn something about how we are to live in the valley. The only thing that's wrong with that is that this is a text about what happens to Jesus on the mountaintop, not really about what happens to the disciples. I used to tell my church council at Holy Cross in Livermore that being the church is easy. It only gets complicated when we put Jesus in the middle of it. Because he has a particular vantage point that we in the church don't always find a comfortable alignment with. And so Jesus is the one on the mountaintop standing in the middle of this mind-blowing, great, white, burning sphere of light, not the disciples, in other words, not us. What are the disciples doing? Well, Luke says they were just waking up when everything starts to light up. Matthew, in his gospel, tells us they were laying flat on their face, presumably scared out of their minds. Maybe a little bit like the women who first came to the tomb and found it empty. It's a good word of caution for us that before we take this text, or any text for that matter, and attempt to reduce it into some sort of moral position or ethical rule for all time, or deconstruct it to the point that it's so flat that we no longer recognize it, maybe we should at least just sit with it for a while. Perhaps sit with it for however long it takes for us to realize maybe we aren't supposed to extract anything from it. I mean, we can read this text 100 times over, and the only moral instruction, if you will, that it seems available to us from the whole experience is listen to Jesus. At least that's what the voice from the clouds tells us to do. And we're generally in agreement that we think this voice probably is the voice of God. And I think we're in general agreement that listening to Jesus need not be quarantined to any mountaintop experience. But I've met some folks along the way who think they can only hear what Jesus has to say when they're on the so-called way up, or they're at the top. As goes my life, so goes my faith. If life feels good, then my faith feels strong. Go ahead and speak, God, for your servant is listening. My life is spectacular. I can hear anything you want to share with me. Speak away, God. I can hear you loud and clear. It's not always so easy when things aren't going well to hear the voice of God. In both Mark's account of the Transfiguration and Matthew's, Jesus tells his disciples to stay quiet about what they've experienced. But in Matthew's gospel, Jesus has an extra word for his disciples. He tells Peter, James, and John to get up and do not be afraid. He could have said, get up and do not doubt. Or get up and do not worry. But the Bible as a whole has a particular interest for something every human is familiar with: fear. Being scared. Get up and do not be afraid. Fear. It's one of the most popular refrains throughout Scripture. Do not be afraid. Which, let's be honest, establishes that there are things, to be sure, in this world that legitimately cause us to be afraid. But the good news of the gospel says that we do not need to be afraid. Wouldn't that make a lovely mission statement here at Peace? Peace's mission is to get up and do not be afraid. But why? Why do you recall Jesus's words about fear in a moment where we're talking about the Transfiguration? When I think about fear and I read through the Hebrew Scripture in the New Testament, I keep thinking about love and its connection to fear. When Jesus says that perfect love casts out all fear, not all hate, not all doubt, not all husbands, fear. Perfect love casts out all fear. So we might deduce that the opposite of fear is not security or protection or confidence or courage, it's love. Fear is the opposite of love. So how does one travel from experiencing the perfect love of Jesus and then find themselves consumed by fear? What's the vehicle that gets us from one side to the other? I think it has something to do with mistrust. When I begin to believe that God's love for me is not perfect, and by perfect I mean complete and whole and enough, when I believe that God's love for me is incomplete or broken or unfulfilled, then I have to attempt to find things to trust in my life that I perceive as complete, whole, and fulfilled. And so I start to think I can rely solely on myself. Myself can get me through anything. I can rely on my kids, my family, my friends, my job, my checkbook, my reputation, my status, my car, my stock options. Those things can be my stand-in God. They can be my American idols. I'll trust them to sustain me, to lift me up, to fulfill me, to make me whole, to complete me, to never let me down, to forgive me, to love me, to hold me, to never turn their backs on me. But when they do, and they always do, fear and panic set in. And we find ourselves saying, where shall I turn now? I've alienated and estranged myself from everything I thought I could trust. My friends no longer want to have anything to do with me. My family won't return my calls. I'll never get my job back. Getting a fix doesn't fix me any longer, so I'm afraid. What should I do now? Interestingly enough, what should I do is another form of asking the question, who can I trust? Perfect love casts out all fear. How much fear does it cast out? All. It might be that you do fear for your life if something doesn't change and change in a hurry. Or it might be the kind of fear that hits you when you look back over your life and you see how you've squandered so much of it. Or you might be the fear you feel at an early age when you look at the way you've laid out your life, but then wonder if those plans have anything to do with the people who are already in your life and not just the new shiny people you'll meet along the way in your idealized future. Perfect love casts out all fear. But the pervasiveness of fear in our lives, even when we don't want to be afraid, makes it impossible at times to feel like we can ever come to God on our own terms. And so because of that, we need a God who comes to us. The disciples do not grasp the significance of what's happening on the mountain that day. They do not understand the transfiguration in the larger context of what Jesus is about. Just days, maybe even hours before they head up the mountain, Jesus has already begun to share with them what must happen, that he will be betrayed and rejected and suffer death, crucified, resurrected on the third day, and they forget all of this when they're on the mountaintop. The whole get behind me, Satan moment is now a distant memory in Peter's mind when he's up on the mountain. And as much as the disciples would have liked to believe everything could have been avoided now that they're on the mountain, had they just really recognized who Jesus was, that he was God to begin with, it's almost as if the chapter before this one smacks of a kind of inevitability and determinism of what must take place. Peter's confession that Jesus is the Son of the living God, the Messiah, will not be enough to turn the tide of events that will soon be staring Jesus down. And so they go up on that mountain where Jesus is now seen in all of his glory, seen as he shall be finally seen when he stands on the other side of death. And it is an ominous yet joyful foreshadowing, to be sure. And while the glory of God is something that we must stand in awe of, if we are to truly appreciate God's character, we dare not miss another part of God's character, which is God's vulnerability. Think about it for a moment. Think about the first time you actually stood in front of another person, completely vulnerable, intimating with your body or your mind or your heart, here I am, this is who I am, this is what I look like, all of me, this is me, unedited, standing in front of you. From the cloud, a voice calls out, this is my son, my beloved. And with those words, the disciples went up the mountain and knew is no longer the Jesus standing before them, for he himself is stripped bare before their eyes without pretense, without equivocation, extending his hand to each of them, repeating the words, get up, get up, get up, and do not be afraid. To be sure, this carpenter from Nazareth will point to the glory of God, but this carpenter from Nazareth will also painfully and hopefully point to the suffering, vulnerable love of God. To be sure, if you come down this mountain with this Jesus, your path will be one of vulnerable love and suffering as well. Because the chief act of vulnerable love will be the crowning achievement of redemption on Good Friday. And I'm not sure it was intended, but the disciples get a fair dose of spiritual detox on the mountain that day. To hold on to that moment and to miss the message of that experience indicates that the disciples had these old tapes playing over and over in their heads that made them believe they could follow Jesus simply by staying put on the mountaintop for the rest of their lives. Like they never have to go down again. Especially Peter. He's notorious for saying the most profound things in one moment, and then in the next moment, saying the dumbest things all at once. And he has a knack for terrible timing. To want to build three dwellings indicates that Peter is opting for a religion that transcends the world instead of a religion that transforms it. To be sure, building a monastery for Jesus and Moses and Elijah is tempting, but we don't need them isolated on top of a mountain. We need them in the public sphere of ideas. That God confirms Jesus' sonship to people suggests that Jesus is to be among the people, not on top of a mountain, quarantined and sequestered and siloed off from the rest of the world. This is not a private affair atop of the mountain. Jesus will go to the people, and he will not wait until the people can come to him. And the people will do horrible things to him, and he will forgive the people in the end. And so Jesus stands there outside the nursery with his face pressed against the cold glass, watching his children stretch and cry and giggle and coo. And sometimes God's children catch a glimpse of the one staring back, who is in love by the way we move and laugh, but mostly is in love with the creation, because the creation simply exists. For the one staring back at us, that is enough, that we simply are. We are human beings, not human doings. And this loving parent will not wait until the child can understand or fathom the depth of the parent's love before claiming the child. The loving parent will go to the child, pick her up, hold her close, confirm her value and uniqueness, and the parent will be reduced to tears. But they are not mere tears of sadness. They are tears of joy. Embracing the child, the parent is not reduced to nothing. They are reduced to something. Grace is being reduced to something, reduced to not deserving to be on the mountain or standing outside the nursery to begin with, reduced to being given this incredible privilege of gazing on the indescribable beauty of Jesus in all of his fullness and in all of his vulnerability. To stand in the wake of that beauty, one is bound to have the sense that they are not supposed to be there. And yet Jesus invites us to see him as he truly is, where power becomes vulnerability and vulnerability becomes power. And we can only say, we aren't supposed to be here. We whisper that to our friend, to which Jesus replies, actually, you are. I invited you. Now, what are you going to do with this glory you've experienced? And so reduced to something, we must face our greatest fear, which is not that we can't change the world that we're a part of. I think our greatest fear, in fact, is that we know we can change the world, but that we will choose not to when the time comes. That's at least my greatest fear. In 6 weeks, we'll be standing at the foot of the cross. We'll look up. We'll see Jesus reduced to nothing, so that we might have the genuine opportunity to be reduced to something. We aren't supposed to be here, but we are. We're not supposed to receive such love lavished upon us, but we do. We're not supposed to taste the gifts of Christ's body and blood, but we will in a moment. We're not supposed to have any of this, but it's ours. We are heirs. It's been given to us. There really is something amazing about grace. Amen.